Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Welcome along this Saturday afternoon. It's Unbelievable, the show that gets you thinking, and I've got a really fascinating guest for you over the next couple of weeks who's joining us. I'll tell you all about him. Don't forget that towards the end of the show today, you'll hear feedback on previous week's programming. Thanks to all of those who have been involved in our Igniting the Faith appeal over the last couple of weeks as well. It's wonderful to have the support that Premier Radio does have from its listener base. And whether you're listening today live across the country or via our podcast on the internet, you're very welcome along to the show called Unbelievable. You're unbelievable. Today on the programme, Victor Stenger joins me. He's an atheist, he's a US physicist, and he's the author of books such as God, the Failed Hypothesis. Last year he wrote The New Atheism, Taking a Stand for Science and Reason. Gives you an idea of where he's coming from on the whole question of God and science. In conversation with Victor today, Steve Fuller, Professor of Sociology and Philosophy of Science at Warwick University, somewhat critical of the new wave of scientific atheism, and we'll be looking at his new book as well, Science in Acumen philosophy series, The Art of Living. So we're going to have a fascinating discussion today as we ask, is God a failed hypothesis? And we're going to be looking at that from a philosophical point of view. We'll hear why we might be looking at it from a slightly different point of view at the same time next week. Hope you enjoy the show as much as I will. Well, it's great to have you both gentlemen on the show with me today. Let me first of all introduce Victor, who's new to the show. Victor, you're well known among the atheist community because you've written a number of books, and you're quite open about your atheist beliefs and or non-belief, depending on how you term it. But tell us a little bit about yourself. Have you always sort of been an atheist as long as you can remember, at least, or
I was actually raised as a Catholic in Bayonne, New Jersey, in a working class neighborhood, immigrant neighborhood, where just about everybody was Catholic. I hardly ever met a Protestant, and there was some Jewish people, of course, but that was about it. And I certainly never heard anything except the idea of God. Never heard any atheist talking about anything. I never read any atheist literature. But by the time I was a teenager and I had learned about science, I became pretty much convinced that the whole business was nonsense, and took off from there. Now, I wasn't an active atheist all my life. In fact, when I went to UCLA to graduate school in physics, I actually attended a nearby Methodist church. There was a large Methodist church in Westwood, where the town where UCLA is, and it had a great church choir, which I enjoyed singing in, and
okay.
It was a great place to meet girls, so I went there for a while. I had some nice, it was a very liberal parish, had some nice theological discussions with the pastors.
Obviously, you do wave the flag now, though, for atheism in a more sort of, you know, concentrated fashion. I mean, I understand you've recently just been over in Copenhagen talking to an atheist conference there.
Yes,
Tell us about that.
Yes, there was an atheist international meeting in Copenhagen. Went on for 3 days. Had some terrific speakers, including Richard Dawkins. I was actually the last speaker. And at the very last moment, I changed my talk. I was going to give a talk on The New Atheism, which is my last book, and I decided to talk about my next book instead. that a plug.
Which I understand is going to be about fine-tuning arguments.
Yes, it's called The Fallacy of Fine-Tuning. So And that went over pretty well. So
right.
It was fun.
Very interesting. Well, these are the kind of topics we love to discuss here on the program anyway. So you'll fit right in, Victor, I'm sure. I would be interested to know what drives you to write specifically against belief in God. Plenty of scientists are happy, may have not have belief in God, but they don't particularly parade it. They don't write books trying to show why God is...
I wasn't particularly anti-religious for a long time. In fact, my wife and I hardly ever talked about religion, and because we didn't go to church, and our kids, so we had two children, and we sent them to private schools in Hawaii. In fact, our daughter went to Punahou. She was just 2 years behind Barack Obama. And these were both church-related schools. They had to go to chapels and so on. It didn't bother us. We didn't tell them what to believe. They both turned out to be atheists as well. But toward about the 80s, I began reading about all the claims being made. It wasn't just in religion, but also in fields like parapsychology, and where people were making all kinds of claims that science supported the belief in the supernatural. And I just knew that was wrong, and the more I read about it, the more angry I got, and the more interested I became in showing why this wasn't the science as I knew it.
So you felt that was the call to take up a specific stand.
Yes, it was basically a defense of science, actually. I really felt very, very passionate about that.
Well, our other guest on the program today is Steve Fuller. Steve's been on the program a couple of times before, particularly in regard to when we were doing those debates around that film Expelled, the pro-intelligent design film Expelled. But Steve, you're back again. Thanks for coming over.
Thank you.
You're an interesting character to me because you're kind of somewhat anti-establishment, a bit of a maverick, some many would say, because you essentially are in the pro-intelligent design camp, scientifically speaking. But we're not specifically talking about intelligent design today. We're really focusing more on the whole, whether science has consigned God to the dustbin, whether we can treat God as a hypothesis to be tested and to be refuted, which is essentially what Victor's line is. What's your response to the kind of new atheism, the new wave of scientific atheism that Victor represents?
Well, the first thing I would say is, in a sense, Victor and I are coming at this question, you might say, from opposite angles, because Victor is trying to show that science does not prove God's existence. I'm doing the opposite. I basically think that you need God to prove science. Okay, so that's kind of a bit, and so the book that we're talking about, as far as I'm concerned, my book, The Science, is about the art of living, and that is to say, in what respect is science something that one can take on as a comprehensive worldview, given the way in which science has in fact developed in the West? And for me, that's the crucial issue. The character that science has, which is this kind of all-encompassing, unifying, rational understanding of the universe, which turns out to be quite counterintuitive, but nevertheless intelligible. And that's a very peculiar way of going about understanding nature. It's very distinctive to the fields of inquiry that have come out of the Abrahamic traditions. And so here I think I should say, that when I'm talking about the sort of God that's necessary for doing science, I am talking about the God in whose image and likeness we were created. So I focus on the Abrahamic religions as a whole, you might say, because they share that kind of common belief. It's what makes them distinctive as a set of religions. That discovery, you might say, that focal point about those religions that make them called monotheism, is actually an invention of the Enlightenment. And that, in a way, captures a little bit of my maverick character, because what I find very important about the history of Western theology, and in particular the rise of this idea of monotheism, has really nothing to do with church partisanship. It has to do with something that, as it were, arises above that. It's what, as it were, the different denominations that have been the sources of all the religious wars that have sort of pockmarked Western history. What is it that they actually have in common that distinguishes them, let's say, from Hindus, Buddhists, Confucianists, Taoists, and, as it were, all the other religious cosmologies that you find from the rest of the world? Because it's within the Abrahamic faiths that, in fact, you get the development of science. And this relates to the issue of atheism, okay? Because atheism is a very funny word in Western intellectual history. For the most part, until you get into, let's say, after Darwin, so let's say within the last 150 years, atheism was usually a swear word that you kind of used to describe somebody else. It was rarely something that one asserted as one's own belief. Okay. What, in fact, most atheists were, especially when they were accused of being atheism, was that they didn't go; they were not churchgoers, or they did not follow the orthodoxies of the particular faiths they were born into. And that's fine. And if that's all you mean by atheism, then yes, science is full of atheists in that sense historically. But that doesn't mean they didn't believe in God. That doesn't mean they didn't read the Bible. That doesn't mean that their science wasn't integrally connected together with their religious beliefs. It just means that they were heterodox. Mm. And often they had to suppress those beliefs, and there's lots of stories that can be told about that with various figures.
In your book, you make the distinction between atheism with a small a and atheism with a capital A.
Exactly. And that's a very important point, because the atheism with the small a is the atheism I've been talking about so far, which is just the denial of church-based faith, you know, sort of the heterodox view toward God. That in a sense, if you take seriously the idea that we're created in the image and likeness of God, as a lot of people in the scientific revolution did, they believed that they could personally interpret the Bible and on the basis of that use it to sort of develop scientific ideas that may in the end undermine the church. Churches from which they came.
So is atheism with a capital A a somewhat more recent development?
Yes, I would say so. And this is where we get to issues of the new atheism and so forth. And that's the idea that God doesn't exist, that there's that this is the view in question that one's talking about. Not that one is anti-clerical, but rather that a God does not exist. And this is the thing that is very much put forward now. And I think, you know, Victor's book in this respect is very much in the spirit of the times, right? Mm. And that's a relatively recent phenomenon. I mean, even within the culture of atheism in the United States, I think it's very interesting. And I talk a little bit about this in the book, that if you look at the triumphs that atheism has had in the legal system in the United States up to about the 1980s, and you ask and you think about what would be the role of atheism in American culture, it was primarily in the moral and ethical sphere. In other words, if you were called, you know, if you were someone who stood up for atheism in the early 20th century, up to about 1980, I would say, you were kind of a libertarian with regard to morals. And the problem that you had with religion was, you know, that it was sexually restrictive, right, and restrictive in all kinds of other ways. People didn't have the right to free choice and stuff like this. But then you do get this sea change that takes place with a lot of the creationist trials and things like that in the 1980s. And then atheism starts to become this thing that gets identified very explicitly with science in a way that was kind of a little fuzzier beforehand. Mm-hmm. And now I think atheism as a kind of, quote, positive belief is very much presenting itself as the pro-science party.
Well, if you're listening and you'd like to get in touch with us about anything you hear on the program today, I welcome your emails in response to the subject we're discussing today. Perhaps you already want to bang one out. Well, if you do, unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the place to send those emails, and I'm happy to read them out and indeed forward on any relevant ones to my guests on the program today. And we'll be hearing some of your responses to previous editions of the program, as I said, later on in the show. If you want to phone your response in, leave me a voicemail message. That's also an option. You can do that at 08456 52 52 52, select option 8. And don't forget this program available as of now as a podcast at the show page, premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
I was trying to find a way to sum up perhaps what your point of view is on God, Victor.
First, if you'll allow me, I'd like to respond to a couple of things.
Go ahead.
Steve said. In particular, the notion that science grew out of Christianity or out of the
Abrahamic faiths.
Abrahamic faiths is, I think, is rather ridiculous, because after all, the Greeks had science 1,000 years before Augustine, and in fact, I kind of date the beginning of science to March 28th, 585 BCE, when Thales of Miletus
created.
when Thales of Miletus predicted the eclipse of the sun that ended a war, and that was kind of the first time, at least historically, that there was an actual application of science, not just to build something like a pyramid, but to actually use something very fundamental about the heavens to make a prediction. And so that that was the beginning of science. And if I could continue, if you look at history, remember, I'm just a scientist that looks at the data. All right, and the data are pretty clear to me that science would have been 1,000 years ahead of where we are now if Christianity hadn't intervened with the Dark Ages.
That's an interesting point of view. I mean, also maybe to sum up your view, I read on a website sort of an encapsulation of where you stand on the issue, aside from where science has come from, but that today not only does the universe show no evidence for God, it looks exactly as it would be expected to look if there is no God.
Yes.
So from both the point of view of where science has come from and what it shows us today, you'd say God should never have been in the picture to start with and certainly isn't
in the
picture.
Well, I mean, I claim not only that there is no evidence for God, we now have reached the point where we can say beyond a reasonable doubt that there's evidence that God does not exist. That's the position I took in my book, God the Failed Hypothesis.
There's two things then, in a sense, coming out there, which is your claim, firstly, Steve, that science is in some way reliant on view of God to actually do its inquiry in the first place. This is something you support very strongly in all your books. You've made this point again and again that we can only do science the way we've done it because we've had a certain worldview, a certain view of the cosmos and a certain view of God. But then we've also got this issue of whether science itself kind of has disproved God anyway, whether or not it came from a kind of worldview like that. Well, what's your response then, obviously, to this first issue that Victor raised?
I think the key thing here is that if we do history in retrospect, that is to say, look for precedents in the past of our own culture and, of course, other cultures, it is quite easy to find scientific ideas, you know, of Thales and the ancient Greeks, even, of course, China, India. There's no doubt that there are all these ideas and that there are even theories and, for limited periods of time, even research programs. But in most of those cases, first of all, the science was subservient to statecraft. And in fact, the example Victor gave was exactly of this kind, right? That in a sense, the reason why people were doing science was it was not a pursuit for its own sake to understand the ultimate nature of reality, that being seen as a kind of intrinsic good and ennobling feature of humanity. No, it was because this was very important for, as it were, administering your society and that you wanted people working on this. And so typically, science was very closely connected with technology in all these places where these scientific ideas originally rose.
That's not true at all. I mean, when I was talking about Thales was talking about the nature of the universe being water.
Look at the context you gave for it.
You had the atomists who were discussing about the very nature of matter. That had nothing to do with statecraft. They were talking about the very nature of the universe right from the beginning there.
Well, yes, but the point is
until Christianity came along that people started forgetting about important issues.
No.
They were so bound.
Look, there are other things besides the statecraft issue, which actually is there with all those ancient Greek guys you're talking about, not least Plato and Aristotle. And the other issue that involved is the idea that science is an intergenerational project, okay? That is to say, it is not something that you can just do in one lifetime, as it were, if you have enough leisure, which was typically kind of the Greek view on this. And it's quite explicit in people like Plato and Aristotle. And in fact, if you take those guys seriously, there's a sense in which you could do, as it were, you could do whatever science needs to be done in your lifetime. And as it were, each individual lifetime, as it were, reinvents science for itself as part of a general kind of, you might say, a sort of intellectual therapy almost, okay, which is quite different from the kind of conception that we have of science that in a sense is very much parasitic on the Christian salvation story, namely that there is this ultimate end, this, grand unified theory of everything where we, as it were, reunite with the mind of God, and it's going to take a long time to get there. We go from generation to generation. We're we're going to make a lot of errors along the way, but it's nevertheless still worth pursuing, and that along the way we're going to come up with things that we hadn't thought of that is not commonsensical and really takes us away from our natural moorings.
I know you want to respond to that, Victor.
It's quite the contrary.
Can I put to you also...
We are so opposite on this that I think we're irreconcilable. That's why we're here, Victor. I wasn't
expecting to reconcile.
because if anything, Christianity and religion is a hinder to progress. If once you put God
our notion of progress comes from it. That's
no,
the point.
It doesn't. There's no progress in Christianity. There's no progress in religion. Things have to stay the same. Once you allow progress into the story, you allow changes to take place that you no longer have. You no longer have
Isn't Steve's point more what the framework within which we do science? I mean, to quote from your book here, Steve, you talk actually about your very area, Victor, which is physics, and you talk about physicists. You say, alongside Newton, we could place Roger Bosevich, Michael Faraday, Lord Kelvin, James Clerk Maxwell, and Ludwig Boltzmann, all of whom saw the hand of God in the counterintuitive, if not downright supernatural, remote control properties associated with what we now recognize as electromagnetic fields. You suggest that these people's understanding that this could be grasped was based in their understanding that there was a system within which they were working, which made it.
That's right.
They couldn't be anything but religious, because if they weren't, they would have had their heads handed to them.
Steve,
it is also true. I should say that it is also true that there were good scientific arguments for the existence of God up until recent times. But now I think most of those arguments, in fact, all of those arguments, can be sufficiently countered. Arguments from design, for example, they were good arguments.
But are you suggesting that none of those people had, that their faith made no difference to them in their pursuit of the science that they did? Because from what they've actually written, they blatantly contradict that, many of them.
I don't think so. I think if you look at what Newton wrote, he was quite more of a deist. Than a theist. He even though he held the chair in Trinity College, he didn't believe in the Trinity. Most of these early
But a deist is not an atheist. But this is a very important point.
In any case, we're not talking. I don't know why do you want to talk about science 400 years ago? Let's talk about it today.
Can I just allow Steve to respond? Yeah, look. The point here about all these guys that got mentioned here is, first of all, It's not that they were suppressing, that somehow they were just, as it were, officially religious. In fact, if you look at the religious views amongst these people, they're quite nuanced, most cases quite heterodox, actually, and actually some of them did get a bit into trouble in their lifetime. But it was very intimately related with the kind of science they were doing. I would say, in a sense, what marks them as scientists as opposed to theologians is basically the means by which they were trying to realize their understanding of God. So rather than spending most of their time, let's say, doing biblical exegesis, right, the understanding of God that they had in their relationship to God was being expressed through designing experiments in physics by doing mathematics, okay? And as it were, this is kind of you get this kind of hybrid feel that all these people contributed to, as well as Newton, natural theology. Right, which is this point, which is very unpopular now, I know, in a lot of theological circles, but basically, in a sense, where you do science to discover God. And this, I think, has been a very powerful motivator well into the late 19th, early 20th century.
But that's not the way history happened. I mean, you make up. You're famous, incidentally, for making up history.
This is true what I'm saying.
I mean, for within a generation of Newton, you had people like Laplace. You had the Enlightenment. I mean, the whole Enlightenment was the first time in history, probably, that people began, except maybe in ancient India, where people began to question the whole notion of God, the whole
authority, okay? In fact, what they were doing in the Enlightenment, for the most part, this is where we get our notions of monotheism from. It was basically, as it were, separating the wheat from the chaff of religion. In other words, there was definitely, as you have suggested, there was this view that a lot of religion was nothing but, quote, priestcraft. right? So there was a very strong anti-clerical streak in the Enlightenment. There's no doubt about it. But that was being kept separate from very fundamental notions of the Abrahamic faiths, especially the idea that we are endowed with reason, God-given reason, which distinguishes us from other creatures, which is what enables us to understand the universe as well as we do. And they definitely wanted to preserve that, and that's why they were very keen on not being atheists, but on being these kind of intermediate positions, deist being one of them, Unitarian. There were all these kind of positions that were carved out during the
Enlightenment. And what basis do you have to say that comes from the Abrahamic faith? Where is it in the Bible that
they said it? I mean, the point is, they are the ones who invented the term monotheism.
Yes, but if they happened to be religious at the time, everybody was religious at the time.
There could have been
no religion whatsoever at that time.
A lot of these guys got into trouble for their heterodox beliefs.
The same developments would have occurred had there been no religion at all.
Is your point though that it's because of this, the fact you see this trend of science emerging from these monotheistic, specifically monotheistic religions in the world, and not from other religious systems, that you draw because
contrary to what Victor says, in fact, within the monotheistic faiths, there is this strong tradition of eschatology, which is to say that there is a kind of destiny to the human condition, salvationism. And what's common to all these stories, which in the history of Protestantism gets called providentialism, is the idea that it's going to be a long, hard trek to salvation, that it's not going to happen overnight. There's going to be a lot of obstacles in the way, but nevertheless, it is worth pursuing. And it's that kind of idea of thinking about the human condition as a kind of rationally organized intergenerational task. That is what science, as it were, picks up as its kind of institutional shell.
Well, we're going to have to take a break. I'm sure, Victor, you'll want to respond again. But it would be interesting, in a sense, to move that discussion on to now. Victor said, well, let's talk about science now, not 400 years ago. And why you would say that still resonates today, and why Victor obviously feels that's bunk. And we'll get back to the discussion in just a short moment. Fascinating stuff. I hope you're enjoying it. Victor Stenger, famed US physicist, with me on the show today, and indeed next week. I'll tell you shortly what he's doing next week here on the show. But looking both at Victor's failed God hypothesis theory, and taken from the title of his book, God, the Failed Hypothesis, alongside Steve Fuller's latest book, which is Science in Acumen's series, The Art of Living. So you can find out more details about both of those with the podcast of this online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. We're going to continue this lively discussion today on the show in just a short moment's time after a quick break.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, we've had a ding-ding and a timeout from this boxing match today. But no, in all seriousness, the views of my guests today radically differ. And so it's not surprising they've got some passion in what they're saying. We're looking at the question today, is God a failed hypothesis, philosophically speaking? Next week, we're actually going to be asked that from a statistical point of view, looking at the scientific data that our guest today, Victor Stenger, marshals in his book, God, the Failed Hypothesis. That was a New York Times bestseller, and he also wrote recently The New Atheism, Taking a Stand for Science and Reason. Victor, a much lauded scientist, he's Emeritus Professor of Physics at the University of Hawaii, Adjunct Professor of Philosophy at the University of Colorado, and probably many more titles beside. He's in conversation today with my other guest, Steve Fuller, who's a Professor of Sociology at Warwick University, and is somewhat considered a bit of a maverick in the way he approaches the whole debate, but he's very critical, certainly, of the new wave of scientific atheism, of which Victor is a flag bearer. His new book, Science, in Acumen's philosophy series, The Art of Living, defends the idea that belief in God is fundamental to scientific inquiry, and that's really where our conversation has been focused thus far. So, gentlemen, I was saying we should probably move the ground slightly now. We've talked about whether, you know, you both obviously disagree on whether there is a sort of Judeo-Christian basis on which science had to be fertilized, as it were. But Coming is a word to today. Your feeling is whatever you believe about that, you can't possibly look at the scientific findings we have of today and still rationally hold to belief in God. And in a sense, what your book did, God the Failed Hypothesis, Victor, is very much treat God as a testable hypothesis and say, well, let's look at the data. Does it fit? No. Therefore, we flunked God on this. So I mean, what? Maybe give us we can't go into great detail, but just some of the key things that for you made that hypothesis void, as it were.
Yes. The basic point, first of all, is that when I say we can demonstrate or even prove beyond a reasonable doubt that God does not exist, I'm talking about the God most people worship, who's a God that most the Judeo-Christian, Islamic God, and possibly other religions as well, who plays such an important role in the universe, is so active in the universe, is responsible for every leaf falling to the ground, is responsible for every atomic transition in every one of the billion galaxies, 100 billion galaxies that are within our horizon, and the hundreds and hundreds of billions and billions of galaxies beyond our horizon. That God also listens to every human thought and answers prayers and talks to people and gives them information that they would not otherwise have known. All of that is testable. And the tests all fail. There's no evidence that prayer works. There's no evidence that God talks to people. There's no sign of God in the cosmos. There's no reason to introduce God to explain the creation of the universe. We have plausible scientific, physics, cosmological explanations for all these phenomena.
I mean, I know that next week we'll deal with this in a little bit more detail. You're going to be speaking to David Bartholomew, who contests this idea that you can treat God in that way, sort of put him in, test tube in that sense.
Yes, actually, I'm very familiar with Bartholomew's book, and I discussed it with some
fellow atheists recently.
Acceptance in my book, Quantum Gods.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. Well, it's great that we'll have you guys meeting next week, and because he wants to take you up on this idea that you can test prayer in that way. You can do these things because he obviously has a different view of things as a statistician. But Steve, what's your response to this kind of approach to looking at God? And is this the role of science? Is this what is God a concept that you can do that to in that sense?
Well, I guess let me start by saying I think it does matter what conception of God one thinks one's tackling. Okay, because I mean, the way Victor described God, it was this kind of very vague thing that perhaps is what people pray to. But in fact, the notion of God that was very instrumental and I think still provides a justification for continuing to do science is one where which implies that human beings have a special relationship to the deity such that we can potentially inhabit the mind of God and figure out the basis on which the entire universe is created. So that would justify, for example, a lot of the value preferences that we have within science. So the idea that you can explain the most by the least, right? Those sorts of principles of simplicity, right? The idea that there's kind of unity to nature. Those are not trivial assumptions, and they're not assumptions that are made by all cultures either. But nevertheless, they are very much part of the fundamentals of science, and it has a lot to do with the fact that historically we have been imagining and, that in a sense what we're trying to do is figure out the plan. Okay, and that the plan is something that is within our reach to understand because we have a special relationship with the designer. Now, if you take that off the table, if you think that you in some sense have falsified the God hypothesis, the question that you immediately have to ask is, why continue doing science in the way we've been doing it?
Well, why is that? I mean, why do you have to? Why is God so necessary, though? Why can't it just be a blank fact of life that we have discovered a set of principles which seem to be drawing us towards this idea that there is a grand unified theory, and that is the goal of Victor's
area. Science works. It's a process that works.
This is the problem. You really don't want to use that criteria. This is the problem. You think this is a great criteria, but then you have to look at the costs as well as the benefits. Yes, science works. It works to build bombs. Mm-hmm. Okay? For every scientific discovery you make that has some benefits, not only theoretically but also practically, there are loads that are negative. And if you did a real balance sheet about science, and if you were judging science purely as a balance sheet idea, there would be an open question about whether we should have been pursuing science all along. It's only if you think there's some ultimate payoff down the road that it's worth going through all the trouble, all the wars, all the destruction that science has, in fact, been responsible for. And I'm not saying this is someone who's anti-science. I'm being kind of realpolitik about this, that if you're going to put, as it were, the benefits of science on the table, well, then make sure you put the costs on the table, too.
Yes, but the benefits so far exceed the costs. If you really feel that way, why are you here on the radio? Why aren't you sending out smoke signals?
Actually, I do agree that science. I do agree, but it's not because I do a cost benefit analysis of it. It's because I have faith that ultimately we are actually going to be able to figure out the fundamental principles of the universe. Okay, mm-hmm. And in that respect, science is going to cash out the promise of theology. But if I were the sort of person who judged science purely on a cost benefit basis, I'd start asking a lot of questions, and I would cut certain kinds of funding immediately.
Sure. You can do that. You can ask questions. You have every right to do that. I mean, and I think
nuclear energy, genetics, all of that would go if you look at the destruction it's caused.
Well, we don't know yet.
We do know
about
that
nuclear
actually.
Energy.
We
know that we may have to rely on nuclear energy whether we like it or not. But these are all issues certainly to be
I'm just
to
saying
be argued
do not
about.
Want to use a cost benefit analysis to
but
judge science.
I claim that science is does not today. Scientists do not think in terms of some ultimate reality. They just I've worked with science. I did science for 40 years. I did research for 40 years.
Look, I know.
And let me tell you, a research scientist gets involved with his project and is interested in gathering data and
why should the public fund it?
Because science has proved to be very useful. Where would you be without electricity?
If you do a cost benefit thing, it goes both ways.
Would you like to have your tooth pulled by a barber? Come on,
I like taking risks.
You ask any citizen today. You take a poll of citizens today, and ask them whether they would rather be with or without science, and you know what the answer would be.
Yes, but the issue is why, right? What makes it rational to do this?
Because it works. It's a procedure that
works. Goes cuts both ways.
I mean, I can see there's obviously you're not going to agree on this. In some sense, though, many people might ask Victor, as you study physics and look, you know, if the object of physics is this grand unified theory of everything, you could easily.
Incidentally, I don't think it is necessarily.
But in a sense,
you do it because you have curiosity and you want to learn and you want to.
Isn't this
advance?
One of the points that Steve is making though? Is that this if you like almost it has no evolutionary advantage to us to have this inquiry, this sense of wanting to know, just because it's good to know, not because it necessarily even has an advantage.
We don't need. I think the human race has pretty much stopped evolving, so we don't need an evolutionary reason for something. We've gone beyond evolutionary reasons. We want to learn how to think.
What kind of a Darwinist are you then?
Well, I'm a Darwinist with respect to biology. But biology operates on an enormous time scale, and we've only been around 150,000 to 200,000 years. I haven't enough time for evolution to make much difference.
Wait till we get enough nuclear radiation. Genetic mutation like crazy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I suppose one of the questions I want to ask you as well is one of the chapters of Steve's book is, what has atheism ever done for science? Mm-hmm. I mean, Steve's contention is that far from being this block on science, Christianity has been this force which has fertilized the scientific inquiry that you talk of. And he's suggesting, actually, that things like... one of the interesting things you say in your book, Steve, is that had, if you like, Darwin come before Newton, we would have had a much impoverished sense of scientific inquiry, because whereas Newton bequeathed, well, I'll quote from what you say when Huxley talked about this himself, actually, who was obviously a great supporter of Darwin, you say Huxley's point was that had Darwin preceded Newton, Newton would have been bequeathed with a downscaled sense of human aspiration as just one among many animal species destined for extinction. He would have had no basis for believing that he could think his way out of his material moorings.
I just don't see why Newton wouldn't have been still Newton. He was another scientist, like so many research scientists that I've met, who was carried away with his own work in his laboratory and was motivated by curiosity about how the world worked.
But Newton was doing more than just focus on a laboratory, right? And in fact, the lab part of Newton's work is probably, in a way, you know, kind of the tail of the dog, right? I mean, Newton was very concerned with having a kind of mathematically unified picture of nature, which, under one set of laws, put together terrestrial and celestial motions, which to the naked eye look radically different from each other. But nevertheless, he somehow believed, and why did he believe this, that somehow there was a unified mathematical picture? Well, it was because he thought he was getting in the mind of God. But if you've got Darwin coming first, and you know, and Darwin basically saying our knowledge is for purposes of adapting to our environment and is primarily sensorily based, you will never have any kind of incentive to think that, as it were, parts of the world that behave radically differently should be thought about together as part of one unified system.
Well, look, I mean, 7%, only 7% of the National Academy of Sciences in the U.S., the elite group of scientists in the U.S., believe in a personal God. So they obviously don't have such a motivation. Most scientists don't have such a motivation. In fact, the scientists that I know who are believers are all people who pretty much have two different parts of their brains. They have one part of their brain that is their religion, and another part that's their science, and the two of them never mix. They put the science aside when they go into the church, the church on
I have
Sunday,
actually said this as a joke.
And it's not a joke. It's a fact.
You take it seriously. It's a joke, though. It really is. Well, I'd love to see the brain scientist come up with this hemispheric differentiation of science and religion.
Well, I mean, obviously you feel then that science, religion, if people have religious beliefs, they are purely coincidental to their scientific understanding and their scientific approach.
Antithetical to it. They obviously have to shut their science down to believe.
What Steve's proposing, though, is that whether they realize it or not, they are dependent on a Judeo-Christian understanding, which their science was birthed in to give. Now, the question, though, I want to look at right now is, you know, Steve, respond to this quote from Victor that we have. That not only does the universe show no evidence for God, it looks exactly as it would be expected to look if there is no God. I mean, do you think Victor is in the position to be able to make the judgment of what the universe should look like in the first place if there were a God behind it?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question, too. I mean, I guess I would, my response to this would be first of all, is this the spirit of the comment? Is it meant just to, as it were, allow the possibility that the way we understand the physical universe is compatible with atheism, which in a sense I have no disagreement with? I think the question comes with motivating the scientific enterprise once you take atheism really seriously. That's the where I would come in and say, okay, Victor, let's grant you your point. Now why do we do science?
Okay.
I'll give you a real concrete example of this, because Victor has been talking about how working scientists don't need to believe in God, and if they do, they put it on one half of their brain. If you look at somebody like Steven Weinberg, for example, who's very much responsible for trying to unify the laws of nature, Nobel Prize winner, also a very important popular science writer. And he is a professional atheist, you might say, and in fact, one of the darlings of the new atheist crowd. I think one of the things that's very striking if you read his works is he has a really hard time justifying the kind of science that he does, which is the kind of science I'm talking about, in anything other than what I think would be regarded as subjective terms. In other words, there's a kind of a beauty to the aesthetics of having simple unified laws. There's this curiosity argument that gets trotted out, right? There are all these sorts of arguments. And while I'm sure they're quite persuasive to Weinberg, there is a question as to why is knowledge produced out of those motives something that everyone should have an interest in? Why should be setting the gold standard for knowledge in general, right? Why should we be paying it so much attention rather than just treating it as a kind of elite hobby for very smart people? And I think that's kind of the problem that you end up with if you really take God off the table, is that in a sense you can justify continuing to do science in the sort of Newton-Einstein way, as Weinberg does, but it becomes justifiable only as an elite hobby. It doesn't become justifiable as a form of knowledge that we should make the gold standard of all the knowledge we have and somehow think of it as the vanguard of our becoming, you know, what human beings are meant to be.
Well, that's true that physicists such as Weinberg are what might be called Platonists. Namely, they do believe that that their science is leading to some knowledge of a reality out there. Roger Penrose believes this. That's a very wide belief among theoretical physicists and almost all mathematicians, but it is not a wide belief among experimental physicists like myself. Our attitude is that all we know is what we observe. We have no other way of knowing about nature. So we observe the world, and then we build models. And in these models, we invent terms like space and time. Those are human inventions. Whether or not space and time have anything to do with reality, we have no way of knowing. We have no way of ever knowing. And so we build these models, and these models are then used compare with data. If they don't agree with the data, we toss the model out. So the model has to have some connection with reality. I agree to that. But what that connection is, we don't know. We have no way of knowing. We'll never know. And furthermore, we don't need to know, because all these theories do for us, all these models do for us, is enable us to make predictions about other observations. And it tells us nothing about what's beyond.
I mean, I have heard it said, and maybe you can set me right on this, but, well, I often think of it this way, at least. You have a biologist like Richard Dawkins, and you can maybe understand his natural bent towards atheism, because he's looking at a process which is, which he has deduced is completely, there's no outside effect on it. It's just a law that exists in and of itself. But then I look at physicists and I think, well, surely physicists have a bit more reason for believing in an ultimate cause, a god or whatever, because you work in this framework of this immense mathematical symmetry and beauty that seems to exist independent of you. Now, you've said these models are models we invent, but they're models that we have put onto the physical properties we observe in the world.
And in fact,
surely doesn't it sort of almost cry out for some kind of explanation? Why should everything be so utterly intelligible, and we mere mortals are able to, find out the complexities of our universe?
Yeah, why do the models work?
Why do the models work?
Yeah, that's the kind of working.
It feels to me like that needs.
Why does that require? Why does that require any kind of power?
Are you saying that's just a brute fact?
That
this incredible complexity.
We have no way of knowing. We have no way of knowing, and they don't. And they don't tell us anything. They don't tell us anything about reality.
It seems to me, though, that, and I perhaps this is where my bias towards Steve's view comes in, that isn't that just kind of putting a blank against a huge question that needs asking?
No, because we can answer
when things
question.
Look like
we have,
they were set up.
No, but we have, where did it come we can from? Explain we can explain how the universe came about from nothing, consistent with all we know. We can explain how the laws of physics came about from nothing.
Can we?
We can.
Last
yes,
I heard
can.
That was still a big debate.
I have a book called The Unconscious Quantum. I'm sorry, no, that was another book. The Comprehensible Cosmos, where I work this out. I show you how from just one simple principle, and that is that when we are making our models, these models can't depend on any particular point of view. From that, you can get the laws of physics. And so you don't need, and there are scenarios that you could work out perfectly mathematically for how the universe tunneled by from a previous universe or from a state of chaos. You can argue that it's quantum tunnel, the well-known quantum process that's been known for 50 years. You have a mechanism by which the universe can come from nothing. we have a complete scenario that we can draw to show how it's quite natural for nothing to have
produced everything.
Produced something, yes.
Okay, that's a new one on me because obviously I haven't read the book, that particular book. So, but Steve, what's your reaction to that concept, which at its basis says, however you arrive at it, that something does come from nothing, and we can show that scientifically?
Well, if we're talking about something that is like the Big Bang, that was an idea that was in fact originally invented to explain how God created. Okay, I mean, if we're talking this Belgian Jesuit,
he was a Jesuit priest. He was a brilliant scientist, and he came up with the Big Bang to explain the data, and when the Pope said, "Oh, now you have found proof of the existence of God," he warned the Pope not to say that because it was a preliminary scientific idea, and the Pope should, in particular, be very careful about claiming.
I am making the argument. I'm not making to prove the existence of God with this, but rather that the motivation to lead him to interpret the data in that way was the idea of creation ex nihilo, which is very much a biblical doctrine.
If he had been an atheist, he would have done it as well. I have no reason to believe that he was motivated.
Maybe he would have, but it still leads us to ask the question: Are we kind of forbidden from asking? Well, what caused that, or is that just a question that doesn't make sense to you, or is just
I mean atheists come up with ideas all the time. I mean, and in fact, since most scientists are atheists, every idea that's been
you've got to be careful what you mean by atheist here. Sure, I'm sure most of them don't go to church every Sunday.
No, they don't believe in any supreme being. That's what I mean.
I mean, I have heard it said, though, Victor, that atheists...
They also believe just in a material universe and nothing else.
Atheists who believe in a material universe are desperate to avoid any conclusion that there might be something supernatural behind the Big Bang.
It's not desperate.
And therefore, theories of multiverses
absolutely
and
not.
Everything
absolutely
else.
Not. The scientists are not desperate to discover something new. They would love to discover something new. If a scientist found evidence for the supernatural, they would jump at the opportunity.
But inevitably, we've reached the level of, you know, metaphysics at the point where we stop talking about what we can observe, and we're talking about multiverses and things like that. What makes my belief that there is a God who put things into motion and your belief that perhaps there was a multiverse or something, neither of us have any more evidence than the other? Do we?
Oh, because one does not require a preposterous claim.
Which one is that?
The preposterous claim that there's some superpower out there beyond matter
that
is controlling everything that happens. You don't know how vast the universe is. Not just the part that we see.
But isn't that the whole point of God? That God is big enough for the vastness of the universe. I mean, I don't have a problem. Obviously, I don't know how big the universe is. But the point is, as Steve says, I'm assuming.
But
God
anyway,
does.
It doesn't matter. There's no basis for it. There's no reason for God.
Go ahead.
I would ask you just to get a clear sense of where you do stand on issues regarding the supernatural and the paranormal and so forth. I know you believe that there's no experimental evidence for this. I understand that. But do you believe
experimental evidence against it.
Right.
I go further.
Yes, okay, fair enough. The question I have for you is whether you believe that research should be funded to inquire into it.
Sure, sure.
Okay.
It depends on how much. Now, I think after 150 years of research, ESP could be forgotten about, extrasensory perception and some of the paranormal phenomena. But that doesn't mean, for example, that we can't continue to study the possibility of the efficacy of prayer, because it's only recently that there have been some good experiments on that subject. And by Duke and Harvard and Mayo Clinic, they've all come up negative, and I don't say that's the final answer. So far it's negative, but that kind of work could certainly go on. There's still claims that you hear from Duke University, from Harold Koenig, that religion is good for you health-wise. I think that's quite questionable, those conclusions, because there are other indications that it's bad for you. And so those kinds of studies involving religion certainly should go ahead, absolutely.
we're going to have to take another break here. Interesting you mentioned that study on prayer, etc., that you look at in things like God the Failed Hypothesis, because that will be part of what we're looking at next week in our programme when David Bartholomew joins us. So I'll tell you a bit more about that on the other side of a short break. You're listening to Unbelievable, the show that gets you thinking about faith from lots of different perspectives. My guests in the studio today are Steve Fuller, Professor of Sociology at Warwick University. His latest book, and you can find it with on the webpage and with this podcast at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. His latest book is Science, and that's part of Acumen's philosophy series, The Art of Living. If you want to find out more about the way Steve views these topics, a good book worth reading. And also, well, if you haven't already bought it, it's a New York Times bestseller, God, the Failed Hypothesis by Victor Stenger, to see how Victor outlines his case against God as a scientific hypothesis. So those are the guests, those are the books, and we'll be back in a short moment for our guests to wrap up this discussion on today's programme. Well, thank you for choosing Premier Christian Radio this afternoon. You're listening to Unbelievable. Don't forget, later on this afternoon, you can hear Hip Rock UK, the very best in contemporary young Christian music. That's between 4 and 6 o'clock this afternoon. And Loretta Fenton presents after that with the best of unsigned Christian talent in the UK. But if you're listening, you may well be listening online. And if you are, you can find this show to listen back to again at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Lots of people download the podcast and interact with the forums at the Premier community. So premier.org.uk/unbelievable for those sorts of things. Thanks to everyone, by the way, who has donated to our Igniting the Faith appeal, supporting the ongoing work of Premier, both the radio station and our internet, TV and magazine arms. So thank you for all those who have done that in the past week, and still not too late to do that by visiting the website premier.org.uk. Well, next week on the show, we ask, can you conduct an experiment to see if God exists? Effectively, that's what God the Failed Hypothesis claims you can do. Victor Stenger joins us again as he's in conversation with Christian David Bartholomew. David's area of expertise is statistics, and he says that Victor has used them in a false way in his book, in the way he tries to show that God does not exist. So we'll find out why David objects to things like these studies to show whether or not prayer works and whether therefore there is a God, and why he says you simply can't use statistics in the same way when you put God into the equation. Okay, that's to come next week at the same time. Is God a failed hypothesis? And we're looking at it from a statistical perspective. Right now, let's get back to today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
It's the time of the week on Premier when we get the grey cells working extra hard. And we've had two very astute people in the studio joining me today. Really know their stuff. Victor Stenger is an atheist US physicist and the author of the New York Times best-selling God the Failed Hypothesis, among many other books. And he's over in the UK for a short time, so I've grabbed him as he's over here to do debate with a couple of people. And Steve Fuller today has been interacting with Victor on this whole question of whether God is a failed hypothesis and the philosophical foundations for the very act of scientific inquiry. Steve, you've been suggesting throughout this programme that it's kind of makes a mockery of the whole process if you take God out of it. I mean, one of the chapters, and one of the most pertinent chapters in your book that we've been looking at, is actually titled "What Has Atheism Ever Done for Science?" Is it your contention then, in all honesty, that if as it were, the history of the world had been different, and that Victor's worldview had been established, you know, from that early point in time, that we really would have not had the scientific progress we've had, that atheism is actually a blockage, just as Victor views Christianity as a blockage to scientific progress. You equally view atheism as a blockage.
Yes, I think if Victor's view were around at the beginning, you might say, of science, that what we would have, I think, sophisticated forms of knowledge that, as it were, enable us to adapt well to the kinds of worlds that we live in. If there would be any kind of interest in finding out a sort of comprehensive, unified understanding of the universe, I think that would be treated as kind of an elite hobby that perhaps, you know, kind of maybe on the order of chess. but it wouldn't have the kind of significance as a form of knowledge that it has come to have in the modern times, because in order for that to be the case, that kind of knowledge of a unified understanding of nature has to be seen as reflecting some kind of special relationship that we have to nature, that it is intelligible. And in order for that understanding of intelligibility to be cashed out, historically, the effective way, and I think this is where the necessary condition of God comes in, is that we, in some sense, were created in God's image and likeness, and that enables us to have the confidence to be able to have a unified understanding of reality of the sort that physics, in particular, Victor's own field, has excelled at doing.
And just to kind of also give the other side of that, when it comes to modern scientific inquiry and discoveries, do you feel that the modern advance of physics, for example, has actually left us with more cause to believe in God in that sense because of the complexity that we were discussing that it's shown earlier? I mean, or is this just, you know, you with your old God of the gaps kind of argument?
No, I mean, I think the interesting thing about the history of physics is that the kind of general unified view that we seem to be working toward removes us farther and farther away from our evolutionary origins in terms of the kinds of knowledge that's demanded of us. So whether we're talking about non-Euclidean geometry or causal indeterminacy, all these kind of crazy effects that physicists have come up with, especially in the 20th century, it is telling us basically that a unified understanding of reality is indeed possible, but it's on terms that's radically different from the kind of knowledge that's necessary for us to survive as animal beings. It really forces us, as it were, to raise our game in terms of a form of knowledge. And I think that's evidence for saying, at least I think it can be used as evidence for saying, that we are getting to a kind of higher, more transcendent form of knowledge that people who have aspired to know God were aiming at.
Okay. Victor.
Well, first of all, I'd like to answer the question, what has atheist done for science? What has atheism done for science? I think it's helped a lot of scientists from being burned at the stake, for one thing. I think that, Steve's got an interesting speculation, but he has absolutely no basis for it because it doesn't agree with observations. It doesn't agree with the facts. The facts are that we had science 2,500 years ago. We had science. We went through a period of dark ages where we lost it. And what was the cause of the dark ages? Christianity. And then when Christianity finally began to be chipped away at in the Enlightenment, we got science back. And it's been improving ever since. And so those are the facts.
The scientific revolution happened 100 years before the Enlightenment, and they were basically Protestants, most of these people.
Well, the Enlightenment was when it flowered, let me put it that way. And so in any case, there's no reason to believe that religion enhances progress. Suppose we were to put God into our models, as they try to do it, for example, with the intelligent design theory. You put God in, then you have no reason to progress any further, because once you have in your chain of explanations, you say that here God stepped in, as in the famous cartoon, here's a miracle, then you can't go any further. So if anything, any kind of religious involvement in the scientific process is bound to put a halt to it. So instead of providing for progress, it does quite the opposite. It puts a halt to progress. And as far as atheism, again, is concerned, the great bulk of scientists today are atheists, especially the premier scientists, people like Hawking and Weinberg, the people who've made the great contributions, are atheists. Einstein was an atheist. I mean, you have to look at the facts. Forget about some crazy theory that doesn't have any connection with reality. It's all made up. Look at what the data say.
Well, we're kind of almost out of time. I feel I should let you respond to the accusation of your crazy theory before we.
Well, it's very much in the spirit of the history of physics to have crazy theories that turn out to work. First of all, and these crazy counterintuitive theories. I mean, the point I would say is, I'm quite happy, as it were, to leave it up to the listener to, as it were, do their own inquiries, their own searches with regard to whether or not God is necessary for science to have progressed the way it has. I think it's a very interesting question that needs to be put on the table now, because historically science did arise in a very particular kind of way. And of course, we are living in a period where atheism is becoming certainly more fashionable and more outspoken and more prominent. And then the question becomes, okay, on what basis then do we continue to support science at the levels that we at which we have been supporting it, given all the things that science does, not only the good stuff, but the bad stuff, right? Not only the stuff that's very easy to understand, but also the very abstract stuff that takes us to sort of regions of the galaxy we'll never have any kind of sensory contact with. And it seems to me that's a very important question to ask. If you take God out of the picture, what is the justification for giving that form of knowledge, which is so essential to the modern way of living, giving it that kind of significance?
We are going to have to draw things to a close, but Victor will be with us again next week, very kindly staying on for another show. And we're going to be continuing this from a slightly different perspective. And I'll give you a clue as to what that is a little later on again in the programme. But for the moment, thank you, gentlemen, both for being with me.
Thank you. Thank you, Victor.
I'll post up web links, obviously, to both your websites, gents, and people can find out about your books there. But I'll post links directly to those books as well. So we've been talking about primarily, with in Victor's case, his bestseller God: The Failed Hypothesis, and in Steve's case, his new book Science, which is just come out in the Art of Living series by Acumen. So I do encourage you to get hold of both of those if you possibly can. We'll be back in just a moment with some of your feedback to previous week's programming.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, we look forward to continuing the conversation with Victor at the same time next week, as he speaks to David Bartholomew on the statistical aspect of his work. But we've had lots of your response as well to today's show. Don't forget, if you want to respond in person with people who have different views to you, always welcome to log on to the Premier community. The Unbelievable group there, a thriving place for discussion on all matters of faith, science, and everything in between. So premier.org.uk/unbelievable. You can click on the icon for the Premier community. It'll take you straight to the Unbelievable group there. And if you want to get in touch with me, the easiest way to do that is to email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. About to read a lot of your emails from the last few weeks, but you can also, of course, leave me a voicemail message, 08456 52 52 52, and select option 8 to leave me one of those. Let's see what you've been saying about the show in the last few weeks. Now, last week we were talking about slavery in the Bible. David Instone Brewer was in conversation with the Bible Geek, American scholar Bob Price, with different views on whether the Bible, if you like, condemns slavery, how far it goes, if you like, in criticizing the institution. Should it have gone further? Should Paul the Apostle have, if you like, nailed his colours to the mast and said slavery is wrong? Why didn't he go that far? All those sorts of issues were discussed in last week's programme. Now, here's one from Manuel, who says, "Hi, your program is very good. Congratulations. I'm Manuel from Brazil. Concerning slavery, there are a lot of papal documents against it, and you list documents going back to the 1400s, which various popes have obviously written on the issue of slavery. You say, I don't think it's fair to blame Christianity for slavery, but individual Christians have been responsible for it. And slavery in the Bible was simply the employment system of the time, and it's quite different from the employment system in the Middle Ages and different from what we have now. And I hope that in the future we could have an employment system even better than what we have now. Thank you very much." And it was interesting to kind of get to grips with what exactly it meant to be a slave and the kind of things associated with that. We may have a different idea of what it would mean to be a slave in today's society. Ephraim wants to go back to the show before that. We were looking at that interesting book from Adam Bradford, The Jesus Discovery. And Ephraim wants to comment on the way that Adam, if you like, in that book claims that Jesus was more than just an itinerant preacher from a poor and lowly background, but he was a well-schooled Jewish rabbi who would have been well-known to the authorities before he started his preaching. Ephraim says, obviously, as a Jewish listener to Premier, the debate was of great interest to me. Firstly, with regard to this notion of an ignorant fisherman, it should be noted that Jews then, as now, were a highly literate society. It was the duty of the Jewish father to teach his son Torah and a trade. Hence, most of the great rabbis were craftsmen. Dr. Bradford, however, seems to take the hard route when trying to prove that Jesus was educated. A glance at Jesus' teachings will indicate that, both in style and content, they are typically Pharisee, i.e. rabbinic. Most, if not all of them, can be paralleled in some traditional Jewish source. In fact, even some of the parables can be found in the primary rabbinic source, the Talmud. Hence, Jesus' teachings were not some radical departure from Jewish tradition. He was merely advocating a shift of emphasis from ritual to moral. He was certainly not out to found a new religion with himself as the deity. That came later with Paul and the influx of Gentiles into the movement, but that's another matter. Anyway, thanks for an interesting program, not to mention a nice web page too. And you thank me for the way I conduct the debates. Thank you, Ephraim. Of course, many would contest the last part of your email there, that he wasn't out to found a new religion with himself as the deity, and that was really Paul and the influx of Gentiles that created that. And we've done that a few times here on the show, what Jesus actually said about his, if you like, God-man status. So if you want to look into that more, obviously many shows available on that subject. But hey, it might be fun to get you on, Ephraim, if that's the view you take, and have a discussion, especially as you're coming from a Jewish standpoint yourself. Linda wants to talk about those two programs we had on homosexuality. She wanted to respond specifically to Mike Dark, who on those programs, as a gay Christian himself, was saying that essentially the Bible is not against loving, committed, faithful same-sex relationships. You say, I fail to see Mike Dark's point of view at all, and his evidence didn't hold much water. His point seems to be that gay relationships didn't exist in Bible times as they do now, and therefore condones it. Well, that doesn't make sense, because the Bible always defines sexual relationships as occurring between a man and a woman, and everything outside of that falls under sexual perversion. The New Testament condemned orgies. Even though the orgies occurred between consenting adults, the fact that the adults were consenting to it was not a factor. The act in and of itself was wrong. I think that homosexuality also falls into that category. So regardless of whether it occurs between consenting people in a relationship or not, the act is condemned in the Bible quite clearly. I don't think the Bible suggests in any way at all that David and Jonathan or Ruth and Naomi were sexually intimate. You're referring here to the suggestion by email and in other ways that we had on those shows that the relationship between King David and Jonathan was more than just friendship, and indeed between Ruth and Naomi. You say you don't see that at all, that in British society it's not normal to have two people of the same sex being close or holding hands. Society interprets this sexually. However, in other cultures, such as French or Arabic culture, you have men holding hands and kissing each other on the cheek. This is normal cultural behaviour and is not sexual. I think all this needs to be seen in context, and we shouldn't interpret it narrowly based on British culture today. Lastly, Mike Dark said that sometimes people may live together because they're reluctant to marry as a result of past experiences, and that Christian rules sometimes force people to marry. I think that if you're not ready to marry, then you shouldn't marry, but also you shouldn't be living together and having sex. You should stay friends with the intention of getting married and seek God's will until he gives you the peace to go ahead. Any church that condones couples living together outside of marriage is, in my opinion, in error. Thank you for a great program, Justin. Can I suggest that maybe if you can find gay people whose orientation have changed, it would be good for them to debate Mike Dark. Thank you very much, Linda. More of a general email here. This is coming from Young Nam, and he wanted to talk both about that program with Adam Bradford and in general about the type of discussions we have. You say, Nam, that you've been listening to the podcast for about a year now and have listened to probably a good third of the archive. Well done. That's a big old archive, so you've done well to get through a third already. You say the discussions have been very interesting and helpful, even though I squirm a bit when I listen to some of your Christian guests. Have you ever considered D.A. Carson for your show? He's a brilliant and articulate Bible teacher and preacher who would do well on a variety of topics. For example, the historicity of Jesus, the problem of suffering, Pauline theology, inerrancy of scripture, postmodernism. I do know of D.A. Carson, and I think he would be a fabulous guest. I ideally like my guests to be with me in the studio. I feel like we always get the best kind of results from that kind of an interaction. But hey, if he's not over in the UK anytime soon, maybe we can get him on the phone. I also noticed, you continue, that I tend to enjoy the Christian versus Christian discussions better than the Christian versus atheist ones. I think it's just because I've heard similar atheistic arguments and reasoning too many times and have simply grown a bit weary of them. I guess it's spiritually natural. There's a time when we have to move on from the milk to the meat, right? By the way, I think a cool series could be to go through the 5 points of Calvinism over the course of 5 weeks. So total depravity, unconditional election, limited atonement, irresistible grace and perseverance of the saints. I think another interesting hot topic could be the role of women in church. Not the only person actually in the last week to suggest that, young Nan. There's someone else emailed me asking if we might do that particular topic. As always, I will put those ideas into the pot. I tend to try not to overwhelm the show with the Christian, inter-Christian discussions, as much as I do love them and find them very interesting. I do see the main thrust of this programme being about Christian and non-Christian dialogue. But bless you for your appreciation of the show. You wanted to also add some points about that discussion between Adam Bradford and David Instone Brewer on the who Jesus was. Was he this peasant fisherman turned preacher, or was he trained in rabbinical scholarship? Adam Bradford said that if Jesus were trained under rabbinical scholarship, that it would explain why Saul, who may have looked up to Jesus, was so disappointed. Well, you say that simply doesn't hold up, since Saul never met Christ until his conversion. In 1 Corinthians 15:8, Paul calls himself as one who was untimely born because he met Christ last. Also, it's clear that Jesus was opposed to the Pharisees during his ministry. Jesus stressed love and forgiveness while the Pharisees were legalists. Jesus pronounced all foods clean. Jesus worked on the Sabbath. And most of all, Jesus claimed that he was the only begotten Son of the Father. I find it hard to believe that Jesus would have learned this under rabbinical education of Jesus's time. And indeed, he did train with the rabbis. If he had trained with the rabbis, he would have been expelled. Imagine how awkward it must have been when Jesus was holding to these doctrines while his teachers weren't. Imagine the academic confrontations they would have had. Thank you very much. Anyway, interesting, isn't it, to look at some of those. I suppose they're in a way slightly conjectural. Any theory about what Jesus did and said and how he trained and how he had his learning in those years that the Bible simply doesn't spell out for us. But it was a good show to kind of to have a little speculation. Seth, just a short email from Seth, says, I've listened to 3 or 4 of your podcasts now. I'm a little behind, as you can tell. I just finished the one from May the 15th. I think that was when Peter Hitchens joined us to talk about his new book, The Rage Against God. You say, I wonder if I'm alone in thinking that Adam Rutherford, the atheist, was not permitted to completely develop any point of view because Peter Hitchens would continually interrupt him. I do love the podcast. I have them downloaded. Try to listen every weekend. Thank you, Seth. And I do appreciate you getting in touch. I appreciate everyone who gets in touch. And anyone who emails me, certainly for the first time, will receive a thank you from me for emailing. Pastor Timothy Deerhamer. Now, you are, for once, someone who isn't in the States emailing me. You're actually over here. But interestingly, I think you're still a Yank. So even when I get an email from the UK, it's still from an American. You say, I've become an avid listener to Unbelievable. I was pointed in the direction of Premier Radio through Tony Campolo's podcast. I'm the senior pastor of St. Anne's Lutheran Church in London. I just signed up to the Premier community and found I couldn't choose Lutheran as my denomination! Although there are only about 150,000 Lutherans in the UK, Lutherans are the largest Protestant group in the world. I didn't even know there were that many in the UK, actually. Have you ever considered a Lutheran voice on Unbelievable? You ask Timothy. Lutherans have a different take on the world than our Reformed and Anglican brothers and sisters, and it's a voice that's not heard often in the UK. Not only am I a Lutheran pastor, I'm from Oklahoma in the United States, so I could also offer that perspective as well. My ministry has been marked by ecumenical involvement. My church in the US, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, even featured some of my work in a documentary. So now pastor of a Lutheran church in Great Britain. It would be really interesting to meet you, Timothy. See if we can set something up. Well, lots and lots of emails. I can't get to them all, I'm afraid. maybe we've got time for one more. Aaron wanted to ask, after recently stumbling across your engaging interview with Alvin Plantinga, he, of course, is a famed Christian theologian and philosopher, you say you've since enjoyed many of the other interviews and debates, that you really enjoy the show. If at all possible, I'd love to hear more from Christian philosophers on the programme. Is there any chance of interviewing, for instance, Richard Swinburne in the not-too-distant future? Yeah, again, it'll go in the pot, Aaron. And indeed, I'm trying to actually set up, if possible, some point, not in too distant future, another show with Alvin Plantinga. We obviously had him for that initial sort of extended interview that you heard. But I'd love to see him actually in conversation with an atheist on something like the problem of evil or his I think brilliant argument that accepting evolution actually is a defeater of naturalism, of materialism. So who knows? We'll see what we can do. I can't promise more than that. For the moment, that's enough of your emails. Sorry for those I haven't got to. And don't forget, you can email me and I will try and read out as many as possible. unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Well, it's time to say goodbye now, but do come back next week because I'll tell you what's coming.
You're unbelievable.
Victor Stenger joins me again. This time he's in conversation with David Bartholomew. David is a statistician, that's his area of expertise, with the London School of Economics, emeritus professor there. He will be arguing that Victor, in his book, God, the Failed Hypothesis, fails to actually use his data correctly, and that you simply can't put God into a sort of scientific test in the way that Victor would like. We'll be finding out what objections he has to Victor's belief that he's disproved God scientifically on next week's show. Do hope you can join me for that, and don't forget to listen out for all the other great programmes here on Premier Christian Radio. But until next week, have a great one.